Risky business. Business.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting, as always, and brought to you by Sophos. They've got a stack of smart people here in Australia, so if you're sick of getting crap support, you should give them a call. Tell them Pat sent you. On this week's show, we chat to a pioneer, an industry pioneer, Nir Zuk, a man widely credited as the creator of the first stateful inspection firewall. These days, he works for the company he founded, Palo Alto Networks. And we're chatting to Nir about his thoughts on security technologies in general, everything from firewalls to IDS to DLP. So Nir is a very, very sharp cat indeed, with a lot to say about the direction that security technology is headed. He does tend to push his own agenda a bit in terms of talking up his new firewalling approach at Palo Alto, but he has heaps of interesting stuff to say on all sorts of topics, so it's really, really good stuff, and that's coming up in a bit. We'll also be chatting with Paul Ducklin, who works for our sponsor, Sophos. Regular Risky Business listeners know that Paul gives good interviews, so to speak. And this week we're talking about an old debate. Is open source better for security? It was a topic we touched on briefly in the OSCERT's speed debate, which incidentally is available for download in our Risky Business 2 podcast. But we thought it was a topic worth expanding on, so it's an interesting chat, and that one's coming up soon. But first, as always, it's time for a check of the news headlines with our good friend in New Zealand, Adam Metalstorm Boileau. And Adam, it looks like those pesky Turkish hackers are at it again, poning the US government and more specifically the US Army through such sophisticated and advanced techniques as SQL injection.
Well, yeah, we hackers have a fine tradition of owning the US military, don't we? I mean, it's one of those kind of rite of passage things, isn't it?
I guess so, and I think just after you said that, there is a cruise missile directed at your humble little abode right as we speak.
Yeah, I guess I better get moving, huh? You got to keep on moving.
Yeah, now, it didn't look like anything that fascinating, this one, to be honest. Just looks like this group called Mosted breached a server at the Army's McAllister Ammunition Plant in Oklahoma, and I think they just did a redirect to a page with some other stuff on it. So I don't think it was, you know, a case that they're going to access the Pentagon's top 10 secrets or anything like that. But still, it's kind of an embarrassing look for the Army when a bunch of script kiddies from Turkey pwn you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, you know, it's still a function of size, really, isn't it? You have that many boxes, you have the skill, you're going to screw up eventually. But yeah, SQL injection is pretty embarrassing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the article did say, you know, they're serving search warrants on Microsoft, Yahoo, and Google, and other ISP and email providers, which I suppose is a bit disturbing in itself. But, you know, we never really see the outcomes of these investigations, so you don't really have any idea whether they're doing a really good job or whether they're just kind of arsing around.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I doubt this will go very far, to be honest.
That's usually what happens, I imagine, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
They're extraditing the, you know, where's people to go after Turkish hackers.
Now, staying with the US, and this next piece actually gives me, what would we call it, Adam? We'd call it hope. We'd call it hope. I have hope.
Yes, disturbingly enough, there is almost hope there.
Yeah, fix the internet. Yes, we can.
Yes,
Barack Obama has piped up. It was actually reported at the time that the computers belonging to his campaign were hacked into prior to the election, and various strategy documents and whatnot were accessed. But over the last few days, he's actually come out and made some very strong statements in regard to internet security, which is that shows he kind of gets it.
Which is a great thing, you know. And I mean, I know I've talked to people who are in you know, security management positions in organizations over here in New Zealand, and one of the messages that I've got from them is that until the CEO gets his laptop owned, nothing happens. And once he does, then you can actually start to make some meaningful improvements to security. And, you know, maybe this is just what we need, you know, an American president who you know, knows what a computer is, and not only that, gets owned.
Yes, he knows what it's...
The George W., do you?
Yeah, he knows. Well, that's because he didn't know how to use a computer. But I think Obama, you know, he knows what it's like to be violated in that special digital way. And perhaps, you know, we might actually see a little bit more attention coming from up on high. You just don't know. I mean, it is interesting and reassuring, wouldn't you say, to see the rhetoric at such a high level heading in this direction?
Yeah, well, I think it recognizes the importance of the issue. And, you know, as you say, we will have hope, maybe.
Mm-mm. Well, I think the money quote is where he said it was no secret that his presidential campaign harnessed the power of the internet to communicate with his supporters. But the incident was a powerful reminder that, quote, one of your greatest strengths, our ability to communicate, could also be one of your greatest vulnerabilities. So there you go. Just nice to – a bit of a sign of the times, I suppose, that the President of the United States is talking about internet security. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, let's see if we can translate that into any meaningful improvement, however.
Now, Gumblr. Gumblr, this new threat, apparently is making Conficker look so April 2009.
Yeah, no, I like this worm, actually. I've been reading about it a bit today, and, you know, it's your average kind of drive-by download worm that, you know, drops JavaScript on people's browsing websites and then infects their machine with malware. But then it goes a little step further and sniffs your FTP passwords for, you know, websites you might be managing from your system, and then goes ahead and uploads itself to your website, which I think is hilarious.
Well, it's a pretty nifty little attack vector. Do you know if it can actually do the same thing with SFTP clients? Can it do that, or is it actually grabbing them? Is it actually sniffing them off the wire, or something like that?
I'm not sure at what point in the network stack it's sniffing them, whether it's an application layer or down off the network. But what I've read so far suggests that it is only FTP. But I mean, a lot of people use FTP.
They do. They do.
Uploading content to the websites, even, you know, in the year 2009.
It's a little bit sad, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
No, it was stunning. I mean, when I first started this podcast, I used to have to use FTP because I was on a shared host, and it was just, yeah, I felt a little bit exposed.
That's because you were.
Yes, exactly. Well, yeah, I'm glad this thing didn't come around and clean me up. But do we know what it's actually exploiting? It doesn't sound like it's got Neode in it. It's just a fairly typical sort of...
It said what the script automatically opens PDF and Flash files, attempt to exploit vulnerabilities in Adobe's Acrobat Reader and Flash Player. So fairly bog standard, high Adobe, you know, sort of things going on there by the sound of it. But, you know, these things are pretty modular. I'm sure it's possible to bodge more exploits into them as they come along.
Yep, okay. Well, perhaps one to keep an eye on.
Well, certainly, yeah. If their botnet grows as well as Conficker, or, you know, on the same kind of scale, then yeah, given that the fact these guys are obviously a bit kind of more aggressive, yeah, it's something that would definitely be worth keeping an eye on.
Now, this next story is a really big one. Credit card processor Card Systems was owned back in 2004. Now, one of the banks that used Card Systems as a processor, Merrick Bank, is actually suing Card Systems security auditors for giving them a tick even when they were storing credit card numbers in clear text in their database. This is a huge story.
And hurrah for that. Now, I have kind of mixed feelings about this story. You know, I think it's great that they are suing them because, you know, this industry does need a hell of a shake-up because there's plenty of people doing a crap job. On the other hand, I'm really worried that they will sue these people and then lose. And then we will have, you know, the court will have approved us doing a shit job.
Yeah, I guess the other thing that concerns me about this is, say they win, then all of a sudden, does that give carte blanche for every single card processor who gets owned to just put the blame back on the PCI auditors? And it's unreasonable to expect a court to determine when an auditor has done a reasonable job from a technical point of view. I mean, if these guys got owned by some ridiculous front door SQL injection bug that the auditors should have cleaned up on day one of an audit, then fair enough, right? Maybe they should win. But how is a court going to make that determination? What's to stop the next company that gets owned through some sort of mega, mega, mega sophisticated attack suing for the same reasons, because there's been some sort of precedent there? I mean, I just don't see how this can work well for anyone, really. I mean, it's interesting, but do you share any of my concerns there?
Well, obviously there are, you know, the scope for the complexity of the issues we're trying to assess as auditors to really just be so large and so complicated that, that, you know, we have a good defense and that we just can't cover off everything. We can't do a watertight job. But on the other hand, like in the case of this, the card data systems, they were storing credit card numbers in the clear, right? And that's a very, you know, the PCI standard is very, very clear about that.
Although, Adam, it should be said that these guys weren't actually required to comply to PCI DSS because it didn't exist. They were complying to the Cardholder Information Security Program, which was CISP, a little bit confusing.
Yes, PCI. But I mean, storing clear text credit card numbers in your database, right, that's a bad thing. And that's something that, you know, it is front door, easy, you know, basic stuff that an auditor should say something about. So, I mean, you know, this individual case, I guess we don't have enough information. But in general, yeah, the I would like to have a precedent that if you did an absolutely goddamn awful job, that, yes, you could get sued. That would be a nice precedent to have. But on the other hand, yes, of course, the complexities of the individual cases, you know, are I guess, what we have a court system for.
Do we have a court system for working out whether or not, you know, what the appropriate level of auditing from a technical point of view is? That's where I think this idea of this lawsuit sort of breaks down.
Well, yeah, and I guess that will be one of the interesting things we get out of this, is whether or not they're willing to judge that. And yeah, that will be interesting to see. I spoke to a colleague who used to work for one of the big four in about 2003, 2004, when they were contemplating doing PCI certification, and he said that they very seriously considered just not doing PCI because of the risk of being sued when exactly this circumstance came up.
That certainly is interesting.
Yes, well, yeah, and I mean, I guess in the end, the money talked, and they decided they weren't that worried about it. But yeah, it's something that people do have to be, you know, wary of, I guess, when you're in this business.
Well, it's something to let your insurance company worry about, I guess. But
well, exactly, yeah, and insurance for companies like small security testing companies, right? That insurance is really expensive, you know, liability insurance, and if you bust stuff, and if we add, you know, yet more load to that, then yeah, it gets even more expensive.
Well, I was about to say, if this lawsuit is successful, then I'd imagine those premiums are going to go up somewhat.
Even more, yeah. But I think this is a very interesting story, and keeping an eye on how this unfurls will be, probably, I think, one of the more interesting stories of the year in terms of, of this kind of auditing policy sort of space.
I couldn't agree more, and anyone who wishes to read that story can find it on Wired's 27B/6 blog, and it was written by Kim Zetter, who did a terrific job with that piece. And Adam, that actually takes us to the end of this week's news. Thank you so much for joining us, as always.
Not a problem, Pat. I look forward to next time.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there with a look at this week's news. It's time for this week's feature interview now with Nir Zuk, who's credited by many as the inventor of the Stateful Inspection Firewall. These days he works for the company he founded, Palo Alto Networks, which makes what they call a next-generation firewall, which blocks by protocol, not by port. Personally, I actually think it's a fairly fresh approach to firewalling in general. It's not trying to be all things to all people, just a slightly more intelligent way of firewalling. And it's an approach we're probably likely to see replicated by other vendors in the future. So now, Nir was in Australia and I spoke to him last week. As I mentioned in the intro, he does tend to push his own technology a little bit in the interview, but he's a very smart cat. And even when he's talking up his own products, it's actually still worth listening to. So I started off by asking Nir if he thinks network security devices like firewalls and IPSs are becoming a tad redundant these days.
Yes, generally network security, the way it's implemented today, is becoming quite useless. You're right. One way to look at it is a lot of the technology that we're using today to protect our networks at the network level is very, very old in terms of IT. You know, it's not from the times of the dinosaurs, but it's 10, 15 years old. And that's a lot in IT security. And it just doesn't make sense that 10, 15 years old technology, such as the IDS and the firewall, the Stateful Inspection Firewall, which is 15 years old, can do anything today. And, you know, guess what? They don't.
Were these technologies that, in your opinion, were effective 10 years ago? Or do you think they've always been ineffective and it's just now that we're realizing it?
I think the technologies were effective 10 years ago for what they were built for. You know, a firewall is not a magic bullet, right? I mean, a firewall has a specific function on the network, which is to control access to the network and, you know, pretty much log what's going on the network. And 10, 15 years ago, firewalls did it well. I mean, the threats that the firewalls dealt with 15 years ago were someone telnetting to the email server. You know, back then, the internet was new. Everything was running on Sun 4 and the new UltraSpark servers. And to set up an email server, you had to install Solaris on it or Sanos on a machine like this. And that came with a telnet server, an email server, and other servers you didn't want. So the firewall job was to make sure nobody connected to the telnet server on the email server or the telnet server on the web server. And the firewall did it very well.
Well, it's funny, I watched your little video where you introduce a product demonstration for the Palo Alto kit, and it was really interesting seeing the way that you described the current firewalls as being basically just like a bit of Cat 5, because everything comes in and goes out over port 80 or 443. But perversely, I consider that a result of having firewalls widely deployed, is that basically people have developed applications to get around them.
Yeah, you're right. For the most part, some applications have been developed in such a way in order to be able to bypass the firewall. You are absolutely correct. In other cases, it could be that these applications were developed to use HTTP just because it's easy to use HTTP. Mm. You know, I don't think Facebook, for example, which is a full-blown application running inside the browser, was developed to run over HTTP to bypass the firewall. It was developed like that because it's a web-based application. It's an application that carries threats with it.
But then we look at things like web services and all these, you know, SOAP XML stuff flying around everywhere. And it's, you know, people just think, oh, you wrap an XML around it and just send it via, you know, 80 or 443 because at least you're guaranteed to find a path.
Exactly. And you're absolutely right. And, you know, all these applications go in and out of the through the firewall as if it's not there. And, you know, the main issue is not just applications can go through. You know, enterprises have rarely wanted to really control what users are doing on the network in terms of what they're allowed to use and what they're not allowed to use. So, you know, having someone use Facebook doesn't seem like a huge issue. I think that the bigger issue that enterprises are dealing with right now is that firewalls don't even do the basic function of controlling access into the network from the outside. The problem is that a lot of these applications today, applications like Skype, instant messenger applications, peer-to-peer applications, browser-based applications like Gmail and Facebook, a lot of these applications, the way they work is that a client sitting inside a network opens a connection to the outside, and then once this connection is opened through the firewall, established through the firewall over port 80, over 443, as you said, the client suddenly changes its identity and becomes a server. Suddenly, the client starts waiting for commands coming in over this connection that opens to the outside and, you know, responds to these commands. So in the case of an instant messenger server, this client will connect to the outside and then wait for a message to come back on that connection and display that message to the user. That's the definition of a server, not a client, right? Something that waits for something from the outside and then acts upon it, that's a server. Peer-to-peer applications are even worse. Emule, BitTorrent, and other peer-to-peer applications, same thing. They connect to the outside. To the firewall, they appear like, you know, just benign traffic. Yet, once this connection is established, everybody can write that connection back into the enterprise and grab a file from your network.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand your approach to firewalling is all about application control, and instead of locking down ports, it's all about using, I suppose you'd call them pseudo-signatures, to block various types of traffic by protocol, and it seems like a pretty intelligent approach. But I'm curious to get your thoughts on where IDS is going and where that sort of technology is going, because I know you've taken steps and you believe that you have the solution for the firewall question, but what about the IDS question?
So I think that IDS today is also a little bit behind. Most IDSs on the market are focused more at detecting attacks, or in the case of IPS, protecting against attacks, going against servers, against web servers, email servers, and DNS servers. Right? That's the focus. That has been the traditional focus of IDSs. And I think that they're doing a very poor job at that, protecting against attacks against web servers, email servers, and DNS servers. I think that you'll be much better off protecting your web server with not with an IDS, but with a WAF, with a web application firewall, such as Imperva, for example, right? Mm. And I think that you'd be much better off protecting your email server, not with an IDS, but with something like IronPort from Cisco. And I think that you'll be much better off protecting your DNS services by using a hardened DNS from Infoblox, for example, instead of Bind, but not with an IPS. So I really think that the IDS, the traditional IDS that has been focused on protecting servers from external threats, is going away and is being replaced by much better and much more effective technologies that are dedicated for each of these services. So again, WAF, email security, hardened DNS, and so on and so forth.
But you can't really fly without an IPS these days. That's the problem. Everyone expects that you have one.
Also, everyone expects that you have a firewall, and the firewall doesn't do anything. That doesn't mean that that's the way it should be, right?
Mm-hmm. So what do you think the future of IDS holds? Because I think it's very easy. It's very easy to look at your products and see what you hold for the future of firewalls. But how about IDS? Do you think it's a technology that we should just discard and look at basic IDS and attack detection and logging and SIEM? Or you know, what do you think the future of the IDS question is?
As I said, I believe that the IDS that protects the data center is going away. I mean, people are still going to use it. I mean, people are even using our product for that. I think that you'd be, again, much better off using other technologies protecting your data center from attacks. However, I think that the IDS is morphing more towards protecting users from being hacked by the internet, you know, by malicious content on the internet. And I think that that morphing of the IDS is going to be quite substantial, not just in the scope of what the IDS needs to look at in terms of the set of attacks that they, that needs to be detected, you know, focus on Microsoft vulnerabilities versus server vulnerabilities and stuff like that, but also with the fact that to protect the users from the internet, looking for exploits is not enough. You also need to look for viruses, for spyware, for botnets, for other kind of malware. And I think that the IDS is going to morph into a device that encompasses what today is separately known as antivirus, anti-spyware, and maybe other anti-X products, as well as traditional IDS technology more geared more towards, again, protecting the client from the internet versus protecting the server from attacks.
Do you think that endpoint software will have a role to play in that type of protection?
So I think that endpoint software has always had a role in protecting, in being part of this kind of a solution. And actually, I think that endpoint security has proved itself to be a more stable technology in the sense that its effectiveness has lasted longer than the network-based technology traditionally lasted. However, there are several issues with endpoint security. The first one is the cost. The cost of deploying it and the management cost. The second one is the fact that a lot of endpoints today are not the traditional endpoint like a Windows machine or a Mac. You see endpoints such as iPhones and other mobile devices, and those are a little bit more difficult to protect with the client software. And I think that the third issue is that one of the biggest problem on the endpoint is the browser, is protecting the browser. A lot of the attacks, a lot of the applications, they run inside the browser, right? Like Gmail runs inside the browser. Facebook runs inside the browser. And a lot of the endpoint solutions are struggling to protect applications that run inside the browser from exploits. It's actually easier to protect against exploits against these kind of applications with the network device than with a desktop, with an endpoint solution. I certainly think that endpoint has its role if you're willing to invest the amount of money and management time it takes to deploy and use such a product.
Now, look, the last thing that I wanted to speak to you about is it is a new technology, but it is very much in its infancy. But I'm curious to hear your thoughts on DLP, because it looks like it actually has some promise. If we look at where it's going to be in 5 or 6 years, it looks like it might be a better way of doing things, just in terms of classifying which data is important to the organization and then figuring out new strategies to take extra steps to secure that information.
So I think that DLP is an important technology. I think it has ways to go before it's effective. There are some very big challenges to DLP today, some of which can be addressed in the short term and some of which cannot. Specifically, the challenges I'm talking about that cannot be addressed may be addressed in the near future is that DLP, like many other scanning technology on the network today, is geared more towards email and web browsing. So, you know, some of the DLP solutions out there are pretty good at looking for data leakage, for data loss over email and over web browsing, but they're doing a horrible job at looking for data leakage inside other protocols, such as peer-to-peer, instant messenger. So, you know, if you take an instant messenger that runs inside SSL and do a file transfer with that instant messenger, virtually all DLP solutions on the market would miss it. Okay, so that's one challenge with DLP, the fact that it's only looking at specific, at very simple applications like email and web browsing.
Nir, I often wondered if using something like ROT13 encryption would actually defeat DLP, and I suspect that it would.
Yeah, many things will defeat DLP. Now, there are actually bigger challenges with DLP. There is a performance challenge today with DLP. DLP is extremely slow. and is very hard to deploy in a data center. And actually, the biggest challenge with DLP is that it's I think that enterprises don't have the solutions yet to classify data within the enterprise and then share that information with the DLP. And I'll give you an example where DLP fails. Let's say you're a public company, publicly traded company, and it's 3 days before your earning announcement, and the entire finance department is working really, really hard on the earning announcement, on filing the forms with the stock exchange you are traded on, like the 10Q in the US or whatever you file in Australia. There's a lot of work around it, financial presentations, preparing to talk to analysts, talking points. All these documents, of course, are very confidential, are highly confidential, and you certainly want to make sure that the DLP knows about them and does not allow any bits and pieces of these documents to leak outside, right? Now, comes 4:30 p.m. Eastern time, U.S. Eastern time, on the day of the earning announcement, suddenly you send a press release out. Everybody knows about your earnings. Everybody knows about the performance of the company in the last quarter. And all these documents suddenly become unclassified. Actually, more than that, all these documents actually
become
going
public.
To start being sent to analysts, to the press, to friends and family of the company. And you want the DLP to know about it. The DLP needs to know that at 4:29, all these documents are still confidential. And 4:30, all of them are allowed to go through. And today, there isn't any good management system in the enterprise to do that. And I think that's the biggest challenge with DLP. And I'm not sure that 5 or 6 years will be enough to solve it.
Okay, well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Nir Zuk, thank you very much for joining Risky Business.
Oh, no, sure. Thank you, Patrick.
Nir Zuk of Palo Alto Networks there with this week's feature interview. Up next, it's time for this week's sponsor interview with Paul Ducklin of Sophos. Without them, there would be no show this week. So thanks again to Sophos for helping out with the bills. And we're speaking to Paul this week about an age-old debate, open source versus closed source security. But as you'll hear, it's Paul's firmly held belief that it's a bit of a redundant argument to begin with.
The way this is normally put, because open source is supposed to be politically free and very cool and so forth, that open source is better for security. And certainly if you try and argue that closed source is better for security, then you make a lot of enemies. My own opinion is actually that it doesn't matter very much indeed. And I'm backed up in that belief by, there's a paper from 2002 by Ross Anderson, who's a don at Cambridge, the computer lab there, who wrote a paper, Security in Open versus Closed Systems. And he came to the conclusion that actually it's pretty much six of one and half a dozen of the other. In other words, you can have secure open source systems and insecure open source systems and exactly the same for closed source. So I don't think the openness or closeness of the source code really makes any difference whatsoever.
No, I would agree with you on that. And the other thing is that tends to complicate the argument is there are a number of strong arguments both for and against that proposition.
I guess what a lot of people forget is that whether something is open source or closed source doesn't really change the attitude you might have towards openness or denial about problems which may be found. And so really, I think from a security point of view, this almost boils down to the disclosure debate. Should you always disclose everything? Should you never say anything about insecurities for fear that they might be exploited? Or do you try to tread a middle ground which gives the makers of software the opportunity to fix problems for a reasonable time, and if they don't respond, then you name and shame in order to force their hand? And I think that's something that brings out more in respect of security than whether or not your software is open source or closed source. I think that's more an issue of how you want to manage and develop and charge for it than whether or not it implicitly will be secure.
Well, I think the other interesting thing about the disclosure debate, and we discussed this last week on the show in the news segment with Adam Boileau, is that, we're seeing a lot more of ODAI actually being exploited in the wild these days before the vendor has received any notification. So I think the days of free and full disclosure are kind of drawing to a close.
Things have changed a lot since Anderson wrote his paper that says that, closed source, open source, that doesn't really tell you whether the thing's going to be secure or not. I think that the game has changed a little bit since 2002, A, because of the, increased sort of commercial, if one can use that word, potential in cybercrime, and also, of course, the commercialization of vulnerabilities and exploits. Now, you may remember last year at OSCERT, there was some chap from the US whose name I've mercifully forgotten, who stood up and gave a speech basically how proud he was that he had found a vulnerability in Samba, that instead of disclosing to the people who write and maintain Samba, actually went out, you know, hawking it on the closed market for vulnerabilities, eventually found someone who would pay him several tens of thousands of US dollars, somebody whom he didn't know. He claimed he had no moral problem with this. And after the time had expired for, you know, for the people who bought the vulnerability, and he told it to the guys in Samba, well, they fixed it in a couple of days anyway. So it's almost that, you know, the fact that you're open source or closed source is almost immaterial given this commercialization of the whole vulnerability and exploit market.
Something that really backs up that point happened just very recently. I had a mate in New Zealand do a informal pen test of risky.biz, of the website, and he found some absolute clanger zero-day vulnerabilities in the advertising system that we use, OpenX. I mean, we're talking about real, real amateur stuff. And I suppose it's because OpenX is a sort of, you know, it's not an incredibly commonly used bit of software. So having any confidence in it at all, and it is open source, but having any sort of confidence in it at all is pretty difficult. Whereas you look at something like SSH, which is used on all sorts of systems, it's obviously got a lot of attention. So I think, yeah, they're both open source packages, but you couldn't find really much common ground in them when you look at the security model, because one of them's just woeful and the other one's pretty tight.
Well, there's also this belief, you know, that source code is invariably easier than machine code. And as I pointed out in my talk this year at OSCERT, looking at JavaScript exploits, and I think last year as well we looked at that, is that people imagine that modern malware analysis, depending as it does on HTML and JavaScript, which implicitly spread in source code, must be trivial. Because after all, you always get the source code, so you don't have to do any decompiling. Well, to people who think that that's true, that if you have the source code, then it is ipso facto always easier to analyze, I suggest you should go and have a look at some modern JavaScript malware, where the fact that it's source code is almost taunting you by making you think, oh gosh, this should be really easy. And then you look at it and think, you know what, it's still pretty complex. And not only is it complex, it is time-consuming both for a human and for a machine. In other words, the bad guys are able to win with complexity, whether they ship something in source code form or in compiled and supposedly harder to analyze form.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? That stuff is written to be difficult to decipher. It actually reminds me of a funny story, Paul, that I've told on the show, I think once or twice before, but the research team from Juniper entered the Pwn2Own competition for CanSec West a couple of years ago, and they had to find a bug in Apple, and they wound up finding that MDNS responder bug, which was a pretty serious one, and decided not to use it in the competition but to report it to Apple. So they did absolutely the right thing there. But the funny part of that story is after they'd all decided to enter, they're all sitting in a room pulling apart the binaries. And someone came into the room and said, hey, guys, what are you doing? And they said, oh, we're looking at the MDNS responder code of OS 10, you know, trying to find a bug for Pwn2Own. And the guy just said, you guys do know that's part of Darwin. It's open source, right? And they'd been sitting there with IDA pulling apart the binaries and just hadn't even thought to go the open source route to find the glitches.
But who knows, if you think back to the 70s and Thompson's seminal article on Reflections on Trusting Trust, where he's talking about malware that had been embedded in the compiler, at least they were looking at the code which would actually execute. In other words, they had sort of factored out any possibility that the compiler might not generate what the original author of the code had intended. So you could argue that sometimes it actually pays to go to the object code or to the machine code, since compilers these days are large and complicated and very heavily relied upon beasts.
Look, the other thing that does concern me a little bit about open source is it can be open to subversion. What do you think of that? The idea that we have seen packages getting trojaned before. Not normally the really common, widely used packages, but how can you be absolutely confident if you're using a slightly rare or uncommon piece of open source software that someone hasn't really gone into the code repository and inserted some sort of deliberate vulnerability into it?
Obviously, you know, that means you need a, if you might call it a statutory release process, even for open source packages, in other words, official ones, not necessarily the sort of intermediate changes, which use some sort of public key signature, which allows somebody to verify the source code they're getting. I seem to remember many years ago there was a famous bug or malware trojan placed into Sendmail. But ironically, if you downloaded the binaries, then you were safe. somebody had actually Trojanized the source code and managed to re-upload it in a way that looked official. So there was a period of some days or perhaps weeks during which if you downloaded Sendmail and built it carefully from source code, which some people would say is the more secure option, then you would be Trojanized. Whereas if you'd taken the binaries, then you would be absolutely fine.
So it just can't win, can you?
No. And in fact, if you look at what the OpenBSD guys say, they tend to prefer binary distributions that they have built in a known fashion. Because it means they, in terms of the security assertions they're giving for the binaries that you are downloading, that are signed, they can make assertions on how they were built, when they were built, what compiler they were built with, what environment they were built in. Whereas if you're downloading the source code and all the necessary dependencies and then building, it's very hard for them to make assertions that you will get an object or an executable file which is, you know, as trustworthy as the one that they built. So this whole idea that, well, you've got to get and build from source, from scratch every time, because that's the only way to be secure, I think that certainly is a myth.
Yeah, well, I think you're putting forward a pretty compelling case to say that this whole debate is somewhat redundant. Do you think that's largely because binary analysis has come such a long way?
Actually, I think that comes into it a bit. I suppose I'll jump back and quote Dr. Anderson on this one, back from 2002. And he seemed, in the conclusion of his paper, he seemed to see right to the core of this by saying that, you know, the interaction between security and the openness of systems isn't really about the reliability and how you've tested it and whatnot. It's really about a functionality issue. And he said that what we need to do, whether we're open source or closed source, is first we have to answer the question, what should a secure system do? And if you answer that question incorrectly in your design phase, then it doesn't really matter whether you're open source, closed source, or some hitherto unknown form of development methodology. You know, if you set out to build to a design which is not taking security into account, then you're going to end up with insecure code.
And Paul, I believe you actually have a quote in front of you from the 1850s, which goes over some of this ground, a little bit ahead of its time, perhaps.
This quote is from 1853, from a guy called Charles Tomlinson, Rudimentary Treatise on the Construction of Locks. And he says, "A commercial and in some respects a social doubt has been started within the last year or two, whether or not it is right to discuss so openly the security or insecurity of locks." And he says that many well-meaning persons suppose that the discussion respecting the means for baffling the supposed safety of locks offers a premium for dishonesty. This is a fallacy. Rogues are very keen in their profession and already know much more than we can teach them respecting their several kinds of roguery. Rogues knew a good deal about lock-picking before locksmiths discussed it among themselves. So that's pretty much how it seems to be panning out today. So as you say, this is not a new argument, and we've gone through this 100, 200 years ago. His final conclusion, that it cannot be too earnestly urged that an acquaintance with real facts will in the end be better for all parties. And so say all of us.
Indeed. Well, Paul Duckland, thank you very much for spending some time with us on Risky Business again.
Thanks, Patrick.
My mother, my father went across the sea. My mother, my father left me standing on the quay. And now I am a circus boy.
Paul Duckland from Sophos in this week's sponsor interview, rounding out another edition of Risky Business. I'm curious to hear what you think about the whole closed source versus open source debate. Please call our voicemail box and leave a message that we can play on next week's show. The numbers are Sydney 02-8569-1835. Or the USA on 877-688-8417, and that is a toll-free number. And that's it for this week's show. We're going out with another Dan and Al song this week from the album Isle of Hop, and you can buy the album from danwarnermusic.com. This tune's called Circus Boy. Go buy it now. Oh, and one last thing. We have actually drawn the prizes for our sign-ups competition, but I just haven't notified everyone yet. That'll happen next week. Sorry about the continued delay. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Come back, come back, come back, come back, come back. sailed to America. My mother, my father left me standing on the quay. And now I am a soccer boy. My best friend is an elephant, a mirror, my enemy. Do I look like my mother, my father? Come back to me. Did you think that I'd rather the freak show as my family? And is the rubber man my brother? Come back, come back.